First thought, does anyone have any questions or comments or anything like that? Well, let me begin by just reviewing the basic point of the lecture last time. The goal of the lecture was to bring out what at least I view as the central puzzle of the Cold War. What's the puzzle? You look at U.S.-Soviet relations in the period after the end of the Second World War, at least the Second World War in Europe, and what you're struck by is that it seemed that the two sides were willing to live with the system that came into being at the end of the war. At the end of the war, the Soviets occupy half of Europe, including half of pre-war Germany, and the Americans and America's allies, the British, the French, occupy the western part of Europe. Right? And it seems not just that both sides are willing grudgingly to acquiesce in the new status quo of a divided Europe. It's a lot more positive than that. I mean, I must say this for me was like one of the big surprises of the documents, especially the big collection of American documents dealing with the Potsdam Conference, enormous collection, published in 1960. Actually, it came to be published almost by accident. Republicans during the early Cold War period had this whole line that President Roosevelt had been terribly naive, had he kind of gave the Soviets half of Europe on a silver platter. The Yalta Conference was this big sellout of the East Europeans, and that sort of line. They introduced, when they took control of the Congress in the beginning of the Eisenhower period, 1953, they introduced legislation calling for the publication of the Yalta documents. And for good measure, the legislation said the records of all the wartime conferences should be published. In other words, Tehran 1943 and Potsdam 1945. And the Eisenhower administration, Eisenhower Secretary of State John Foster Dulles, he thought these charges about Yalta were just total nonsense. But he wanted to get all this stuff out. And in fact, the State Department historians went to work on this, and they published the records, and including the records of the Potsdam Conference in 1960. This was, and it was, when I went through this stuff, I just couldn't believe what the U.S. policy was. The U.S. policy was to accept the status quo, to accept Soviet control of their half of Europe, right? That's the meaning of the Burns Plan for Reparations, which is the key to what U.S. policy was on Germany. And the German question lay at the heart of the Potsdam Conference, in fact, lay at the heart of the whole question of the post-war settlement. And why was the Burns Plan so important? You know, It's like reparations would be dealt with on a zonal basis. Soviets could take whatever they wanted from the part of Germany they controlled. We and our friends would take whatever we wanted from the part of Germany we controlled, right? Germany was to be divided, not in four parts, but two parts, between East and West, because the assumption was that the three Western powers would have no trouble working together in terms of establishing some sort of political and economic system in their half of Germany, right? But the treatment of the reparations implied that Germany's foreign trade would also have to be managed on a zonal basis. There would be no unified all-German system for the management of Germany's exports and imports. Why was this? Because the Soviets were free to kind of strip the eastern zone. That would mean, if Germany would run as a unit, that the deficit for Germany as a whole would be greater than it would otherwise be, the trade deficit. Who was going to foot the bill for that that deficit if Germany would run as on a unified basis? The more the Soviets stripped the East, the more the Americans would have to pay. We didn't want to basically pay Germany's reparations for her. We were unwilling to foot the bill for that. And so the implication of the plan for the reparations was that Germany's foreign trade would also be run on a zonal basis. Soviets would be responsible for financing whatever deficit their part of Germany ran, and we and our friends would be responsible for taking care of Western Germany. But the management of Germany's foreign trade was the key to the overall economic treatment of Germany, because if Germany was not run as a unit for purposes of foreign trade, the two parts of Germany would have to relate to each other as though they were foreign countries engaged in international trade, or more precisely, in international barter. And then if Germany was divided economically between East and West, then that implied that Germany would be divided ultimately politically between East and West. And all these things were abundantly clear to people at Potsdam at the time, people who were privy to what was going on here. Which is, you know, these negotiations were secret, but people who were, both the U.S. and British government who were aware of these things had no doubt about what was going on. And the Soviets, for their part, who tended to think in spheres of influence terms anyway, were quite happy to accept the deal that Burns was offering, right? It was not embedded, strictly speaking, in the formal document that was negotiated at Potsdam. But it's quite clear when you read the records of the conversations, and we have British, American, two American versions of the notes, plus Soviet notes that were published later. It's quite clear what the understanding at Potsdam was. And Stalin was delighted to accept it. He takes the initiative in extending this basic philosophy in other areas to include, for example, the provision for dividing up Germany's foreign assets. You know, what lay in the East would go to the Soviets, what lay in the West would go to America and her friends. Not just that, but in the subsequent negotiations, the Soviets kind of block arrangements for a unitary system for the management of Germany's foreign trade. They do all these things to make it abundantly clear that their policy is based on the notion of a divided Germany. Stalin met with the German communists on June 4th, 1945, and he told them, this is one of the most important documents that was released after the fall of communism in Eastern Germany, when people were able to look at the East German archives. The East German communist leaders wrote up a record of their meeting with Stalin, and Stalin said to them, in the German text, he said, "Es wird zwei Deutschlands geben." There will be two Germanys. Two Germanys. This is June 4th, before Potsdam even. Stalin told the Yugoslav communists earlier in 1945, he says, "This war is not going to be like any other war. You know, in this war, each side will impose its political system on the areas that it occupies. It cannot be otherwise." Say, and during the Cold War, people would quote this and say, look how awful Stalin was. Look how from the start he tended to communize the areas the Red Army had conquered. The important thing about this quotation, however, is that it shows that Stalin accepted Western domination, Western control of the areas to the west of the line of demarcation in Europe. As, you know, he accepted it philosophically. Burns, I mean, the evidence is quite extraordinary. Burns made it abundantly clear that he accepted a system whereby Europe would be divided, Germany would be divided. For example, right after Potsdam, the new French leaders, General de Gaulle and the Foreign Minister Georges Bidault, come over to Washington to talk with the Americans. And then naturally, they talk mainly about the German question. And Burns says that, I don't see why you're so upset. Because you're now going to be faced with a Germany of 45 million, which is almost precisely the population of the three eastern zones of Germany at the time. Germany's going to be truncated. You know, it's clear they accept it. That's the meaning of the Moscow Conference of December 1945. There are two Moscow conferences, and you don't want to get them confused. They're important in this period. This is December of 1945. It seems like the United States and the Soviets have reached a deal. There's another one I'm going to be talking about later, December 47. May and June of 47. That's very different. But by the end of 45, it seems like the two sides have reached an understanding, you know? You control things in the part of Europe you control. We control things in the part of Europe we control. It's like, on that basis, you think... All right. Let's see if this works. That's what happens when I get so excited. Okay. Why is it so important? We see that there's a puzzle here. How does this relate to the basic issues that international relations theorists are interested in? Well, it relates to the issue of realism. We're using a theory here to bring out a puzzle. The theory is the countries should adjust the power realities. In this case, maybe the United States would have loved to see democratic regimes spring up all over Europe, but not if it meant a third world war. We weren't going to use force to kick the Russians out of the part of Europe they controlled. We accepted. We accepted kind of not just grudgingly, but overtly as part of an arrangement, because we're getting something in exchange. We're getting the Soviets to accept the fact that we will call the shots in the part of, not just the part of Europe, but the part of the world that we control, especially Japan. Right? Soviets make the same sort of calculation. Yeah, well, of course they would love to see communist regimes in Western Europe, but not if it means war with America. And they restrain the communists in Western Europe. Huge communist parties in France and Italy. But they're under orders from the Soviets, 1945, 1946, to not engage in revolutionary activity. This is what a theoretical perspective would lead you to expect. Theoretical perspectives, the basic realist perspective is countries accept power realities. They frame their policies in accordance with power realities. Okay. Does this mean that realist theory provides us with the key to understanding the Cold War? No, exactly the reverse. It explains something that didn't happen. It explains something that you might have expected to happen at the end of the war. Namely, that both sides would accept things as they were. End of story. We can live with a divided Europe. They can live with a divided Europe. On that basis, the two major powers could get along. No risk of a third world war. But we know that there was a big risk of a third world war. People sensed it. Where is that sense coming from? Why do relations deteriorate? Why does this kind of spheres of influence understanding of 1945 not provide the basis for a stable international order? You see, that's the importance of theory. It doesn't provide you with solutions, answers. But it brings the problems into focus. It helps you see things that things are puzzling, whereas otherwise you wouldn't have grasped the fact that they were puzzling. By the end of 1945, you would have said, "Oh, they've reached an understanding." You know, you wouldn't have expected a Cold War, and yet by early 1946, the two sides are at each other's throat. I should say, I'm not going to go into this. I'll tell. one of the basic shots that marked the beginning of the Cold War in early 1946, this was a speech that Stalin gave, you know, about the clash of the two blocs and so on. And one key American political figure referred to this as a declaration of World War III. This speech was given February 9th, 1946, which happens to be the day I was born. And it's like, well, yeah, I remember crawling out of the womb and saying, oh, these are going to be interesting things to study. the famous Churchill speech. I put this on the course website, by the way. The Iron Curtain speech, you know. From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an Iron Curtain has descended across Europe. Opening shots of the Cold War. America is complaining with increasing stridency about what the Soviets are doing or failing to do, really, in their zone of Germany. They had promised, supposedly at Potsdam, that Germany would be run as a unit, and now they're reneging on that promise. You know, how dishonest these people are, what liars they are, a gross distortion of what had actually happened at Potsdam. But it's a measure of the deterioration of the political relationship between the two major powers. It's puzzling. What had happened? It's a historical puzzle, and the puzzle is underscored when you bring a kind of theoretical perspective to bear. It shouldn't have happened. Both sides should have accepted these realities. Why? How is it to be explained? Right? So the perspective, the theoretical perspective, brings flushes out the problem, throws it into relief. How do we get at it? Well, we get at it by trying to kind of understand what was going on by looking at the empirical evidence, the evidence relating to the story. And it's clear that the German question lay at the center of the story. Because American policy on Germany changes, or at least appears to change. For when it had been under Burns at Potsdam, namely the acceptance of a divided Germany, to what it was in 1946 when we're insisting that Germany be run as a unit. You know, what nerve the Soviets have, blocking these plans for running Germany as an economic unit, for managing Germany's foreign trade on a unitary basis. The very sort of thing that the Americans had opposed so vociferously at Potsdam. So American policy had changed, right? We had changed on the German question. Why do we change on the German question? Well, the answer to that is that we came to see that a peaceful order, an order acceptable to the United States, could not be based on consent alone. You couldn't, you know, the Potsdam policy was a policy, I call it policy of an amicable divorce. But like many divorces that people try to make amicable, it doesn't work. Doesn't work. Why did it not work? We know it doesn't work because we know the Americans get up on their high horse in early 1946. You know, we suspend the deliveries of the reparations to Russia that were promised under Potsdam in the spring. And then we announce that we're going to organize with the British and the French our part of Germany. Right? Not just without the Soviets, which they could accept, but implicitly against them. Because we're pointing to the Soviets as the great enemies of German national unity. You know, it's like what nerve they have blocking these plans for running Germany as a unit, for allowing the Germans to ultimately have control over their own destinies. The Soviets are preventing the reemergence of a German national state. What nerve they have, right? This is the whole message that this is given is that the Americans are underwriting German national goals. That West Germany is going to be built up. West Germany is going to be organized under American auspices or Western auspices. This new policy, this is called the Western strategy for Germany. This is what's really important about U.S. policy in this period. Like people say, oh, well, what's the essence of American grand strategy in this period? It was the strategy of containment that we associate with George Kennan, our old friend George Kennan. He wrote an important article in Foreign Affairs in 1947 called The Sources of Soviet Conduct, in which he called for a policy of the containment of the Soviet Union. In fact, containment policy was in place from the very outset. It was implicit in the Burns Potsdam policy, right? We occupied half of Europe at the end of the war. We were not going to simply allow those areas to be annexed in effect by the Soviets, you know, to fall into the Soviet sphere of influence. All the resources of all of Europe, Western Europe, the most economically and technologically advanced part of Europe, having the Soviets get control of all of that. We hadn't shed all this blood in the Second World War to see a new superpower commanding the resources of all of continental Europe. You know, from the Atlantic in the Soviets' case, straight through to Vladivostok in the Pacific. You know, this would mean that American security was like deeply threatened. We're not going to accept that. We're there and we're going to stay there. You know, until there is enough of a power mass in place in Western Europe to balance Soviet power on its own. Right? It's a reflex. It's obvious. We're not going to just see all of Europe slip into the Soviet sphere. Well, that's essentially what containment means. It's not containment that's important. It's the Western strategy that's new. What's the Western strategy? This is the idea that the three Western zones of Germany, the American, British, and French zones, will be organized under the auspices of the three Western powers, Britain, France, and the United States, that they will be that new German entity, Western German entity, will be tied to the Western world in all kinds of different ways, you know, first economically, then politically, and ultimately militarily, that it will be integrated in particular into continental Western Europe, because there was a big continental Western Europe dimension to this strategy. All right. This is a strategy that amounted to telling the Germans, forget about creating a national state. Forget about getting back the eastern half of your country. Think of yourselves not as part of a larger German state, but rather as part of maybe a future United States of Europe, meaning a United States of continental Western Europe. Think of yourselves now as part of the Western world. Right? That's the strategy. And this is a strategy that looked toward the building up of West German power, West German economic recovery, the creation of a West German state, ultimately the creation of a West German army, part and parcel of the Western Bloc, supported by the military power of the other Western countries. We are committed to bringing the Germans over into our side. And in fact, in order to get the Germans to side with us and to kind of put on hold their most basic national goal, the reunification of their own country, we have to play up to them. We have to give them more and more in the way of concessions, more and more freedom of action, political freedom, allow them to create a state of their own, allow them ultimately to create an army. All right? And we're going to support their policy, what they do with that state and with that army. We're underwriting it in order to keep them on our side. Well, as I was saying, this is something the Soviets find hard to accept. I mean, they could accept that what the Western powers were doing in West Germany was Soviets were being excluded from that, just as we were being excluded from what they were doing in the East. But West Germany was being organized not just without them, but against them. Ultimately, there would be a threat to the whole political system that they were erecting in Eastern Europe in general, East Germany in particular, if this Western strategy, as it was called, was allowed to run its course. And so they had an interest in preempting it, and not just waiting until matters got totally out of hand, but pushing hard to prevent the policy from running its course. Yeah?
Was France and Britain in favor of this too?
In 1946, it was the United States that took the lead. In 1947, as I'll discuss, the French and the British actually took more of a hardline strategy than the United States, culminating in the London Conference in December when basically they were willing to go further even than the Americans. But in 1946, it's the Americans that are calling the shots here. The British are kind of half sympathetic to this. The French have this big political problem at home with this large Communist Party and so on. They support it, but in a much more subtle and, shall we say, discreet way, right? If the Soviets oppose this Western strategy and make it clear that they're unhappy with it, and this leads to a certain amount of tension between East and West, well, it's all the more important to kind of develop the power of the Western Bloc as a whole, and that means pulling the Germans into it. Western strategy for Germany. Why? How? You may say, well, doesn't this show that the United States is basically responsible for the Cold War? We're the ones who are reneging on the Potsdam Agreement, right? We're the ones who are kind of excluding the Soviets from the West, not just that, but organizing West Germany against them, going to the Germans and saying, look, we're your friends. We support your national goals, pointing to the Soviets. They're the ones who are the great saboteurs of German national unity. You should side with us and against them. Right? Does this mean the Americans are responsible for the Cold War? No. Why? Because the policy has to be understood in a larger context. Why had Burns shifted course? That's the issue. And a lot of it has to do with what the Soviets were doing on their southern border. in late 45, early 1946, mid 1946. There's this wonderful story. Stalin's foreign minister was named Molotov. And in his old age, Molotov kind of dictated these reminiscences, which were published. And he tells the story about Stalin going to a map of Europe, map of the USSR. And he says, "Oh, I'm happy with what, with our new borders in the West. I'm happy with the situation in the East. But there's one area that I'm not happy with." And he slams his fist against the wall map. And he says, "It's our southern border. Say, we want to make gains in the south, basically at the expense of Turkey and Iran." Say, "Soviets wanted control of the Turkish Straits." Well, it was an old Russian goal. Say, "The Americans have the Panama Canal, the British have Suez. Soviets should control a waterway of equivalent strategic importance to it." So all this pressure on the Turks, pressure on the Iranians. Iran had been occupied by the Allies, the Soviets, the British, and the Americans during the war because it was essential as a supply channel for lend-lease goods to Russia. But the promise was that 6 months after the end of the war, the occupation would end. The foreign forces would get out. It's clear the Soviets were not going to keep that promise. You know, it also seemed that they wanted to kind of set up a satellite states in the part of Iran that their arm is occupying. It's like, why were the Soviets interested in doing this? Who's going to stop them? Not the Americans. Americans weren't interested in that part of the world, so it seemed. And the British were much too weak on their own to kind of stop them. So why not make the effort? If it turned out they were wrong about the Americans and the American attitude turned out to be tougher than they had thought, well, they could always pull back. And so you have the ratcheting up of tension, especially against Turkey in 1945 and 46. You know, it seemed that the Soviets were getting poised to use military force against Turkey, and similarly against Iran. And this meant for the Americans, what are we going to do? Truman's initial inclination had been, we can't do anything. Part of the problem here was that we demobilized with lightning speed after the end of the war. This is a period when there was enormous political pressure within the United States to bring the boys home, to kind of dismantle this amazing military machine that had been built up during the war. And so we didn't need a huge military force. We had the atomic bomb. No other country had it. America's phenomenally secure. All these, soldiers and their families, they had suffered through all these long years of depression and war. Now they wanted to kind of get back and lead a normal life and start their families. This is the period of the post-war baby boom, of great suburbanization in the United States. So we didn't have very much in the way of military force within months after the end of the war. Still, American policy did shift, and by early 1946, Truman and Burns as well, they're willing to kind of take a stand over these Near Eastern issues. And the Soviets did draw back in both cases, in the case of both Turkey and Iran in 1946. You may say, well, there were these crises got resolved, the line gets drawn. Just as the line had gotten drawn in Europe, and basically people accepted Soviet domination of Eastern Europe, so the line got drawn in the Near East. The Soviets would be kept out of both Turkey and Iran. End of story. Why does the tension continue? It's because what the Soviets had done in the Turkish and Iranian crises had revealed something of fundamental importance about Soviet policy. An amicable settlement with these people was just not in the cards. The only thing that they respect is force. It's like this is a story about the Potsdam Conference. That at one point in the Potsdam Conference, the whole issue of the Vatican, for some reason, came up. And Stalin, in his kind of cynical way, kind of turns to Truman and says, "Oh, by the way, how many divisions does the Pope have?" You know, it's like. And Truman initially told the story as this kind of funny story about Stalin and his kind of charming cynicism and so on. Now, 1946, he tells the same story. He says, "Look how awful Stalin is. All he thinks in terms of is military force, right? And the only thing that's going to keep Stalin at bay is countervailing force. Right? We can't just rely on a peaceful, friendly understanding with these people. We have to generate countervailing military power of our own. And how do you do that? By over-defining the threat, by exaggerating how bad they are." Right? And this is a conscious strategy. Dean Acheson, who was then Undersecretary of State, he would be the real maker of U.S. policy in the second Truman administration from 1949 to 1953. Acheson has this phrase in his memoirs about the need to make things clearer than the truth, to over-define the threat. Right? By making all these charges against the Soviet Union and their policy in Germany, you were achieving two goals. You were mobilizing opinion within the United States to support a hardline policy. Look how awful these people are, you know. And also you were appealing to the Germans and drawing German power into a Western bloc, into an anti-Soviet bloc, creating countervailing power. This point is very important because, as I say, the evidence shows that this was an explicit strategy. The people felt like they had to really ratchet up the level of rhetoric, you know, for these domestic political purposes. Once again, this is one of these problems you encounter when you study American foreign policy. You can't just play the standard power political game because the American people is unwilling to allow its power to be used in that way. You have to make a moral case. You have to, you know, say we are the embodiment of good, they are the embodiment of evil. It's the same sort of thing that we saw with Roosevelt in 1941, how he had to kind of manipulate things. Because he was bound by American public opinion. The same sort of thing that Kennan was complaining about in that article you read for the first week. Right? He says, and actually when you look at the history of American foreign policy in this century, you're struck by the fact that the most successful policies are those that are based on taking liberties with the truth in this way. When people are too honest, Jimmy Carter probably being the best example of this, then you have problems. This whole issue of dishonesty has to be understood in structural terms. You have a political leadership that lives in two worlds, the world of international politics, the world of domestic politics. World of international politics pushes it to think in parapolitical terms. Okay? World of domestic politics, they can't frame their policies in that same way. They're forced to kind of pander to public opinion, to frame their policies in a way that public opinion will find acceptable. So their real policies might be based on parapolitical considerations. But they are forced for domestic political reasons to frame them in an entirely different way. That there's a gap between the real thinking and the way it's presented. And that's inherent in the nature of the democratic political system. It's one of the great causes of all these problems. Okay. So the Near Eastern crises trigger a rethinking of American strategy, much greater emphasis on force, on military power, especially making sure that the Germans are going to be in your camp. We have to create countervailing power to the Soviets. Right? This leads to a high degree of tension in 1946. 1947, however, it seems that things are going to change. Burns is out. January 47, he's replaced by General George Marshall. Marshall, Army Chief of Staff during the entire war, highly regarded by everyone in the country, man of immense personal integrity. Marshall is brought in because Burns and Truman had a certain falling out. The problem was essentially personal, not over policy. Burns had gotten the impression that he was practically Truman's equal, that he had more or less of a free hand to conduct policy as he chose. As a result, he didn't really brief Truman enough on what he was doing. Truman turned against Burns. Burns is out. Marshall comes in. And Marshall's concept in 1947 is totally different from what Burns had. Not as committed to the notion of the Western strategy for Germany, because it amounted to the West moving ahead in Germany without an understanding with Russia. It's true, for the time being, the country was in an anti-Soviet mood, but Marshall did not believe that kind of feeling would last, that it would not provide the basis for a permanent policy. Instead, he felt you had to reach an understanding with Russia. If you didn't reach an understanding with Russia, then you're going to have these problems with Germany, because the Germans could play off East against West. And then you'd be off and running again. The Germans would be able to build up their power, and then you have a new German problem. And so Marshall made this big attempt to kind of reach an understanding with Russia. This is the meaning of the Moscow Conference of the spring of 1947. Is there a solution? Can we run Germany as a unit? And by this point, the very idea of an all-German settlement is somewhat quixotic. Why is that? Because what sort of Germany are you going to create? If you create a unified Germany, it doesn't have any military force, you're going to have this power vacuum in Central Europe. It's going to be too tempting for other countries, meaning the Soviet Union, to intervene, because there's going to be no counterweight to Soviet power. On the other hand, if you allow this new German state to build up its power, then you're going to have the German problem all over again. Right? Maybe a divided Germany, not ideal in some absolute sense, maybe this is the optimal solution. Yeah. In any case, Stalin's not forthcoming. He's not going to kind of give up control of his part of Germany. Marshall draws from this the lesson, the conclusion, that there's not going to be a German settlement, that there's no alternative to the Western strategy, and that we're going to have to kind of go ahead with our friends and building up Western Europe, Western Germany, first economically, then politically. Comes back, and very quickly the elements of the famous Marshall Plan are put together. The whole issue here is, would this be an all-European reconstruction plan, or would it be limited to Western Europe? In reality, no one wanted the Soviets to participate. That meant that none of the East European states would be allowed to participate either. The political relations between East and West now deteriorate yet further. The Soviets see the West is building up its own power, first economically, ultimately militarily, building up a bloc against Russia, using Germany as an anti-Soviet battering ram, maybe. Right? The Soviets have certain cards to play. namely these large communist parties in France and Italy, revolutionary strikes in those countries. The situation is mastered, especially, you know, in France. The communists are forced out of the government. And so finally, there's this last conference, the London Conference of December of 1947. End of the road. The Conference of No Return is between East and West. It's very clear. Political relations are just so bad at this point that there's no hope whatsoever for any agreement on a solution for Germany. And Marshall accepts this. The British and French are even more willing to kind of move ahead. And the decision is reached in December of 1947 to move forward with the creation of a West German state under the auspices of the three Western powers, excluding the Soviets. A key development in moving ahead. Okay. That leads to the great crisis over these issues of 1948, which I'm going to be talking about next time. But let me just end. I have a few more minutes by talking about the meaning of this whole story for international relations theory. You're all familiar with the whole notion of the security dilemma. I think I talked about this a bit. This is this whole idea that given the nature of the international system, what's called the anarchic nature of the international system, that countries have to provide for their own security, that no one is going to guarantee them their security as a matter of right. They're forced to pursue policies which other countries are going to find threatening. They're forced to pursue offensive policies for essentially defensive reasons. This story of the early Cold War, you find a lot of that stuff. You don't need to assume an aggressive Soviet policy or an aggressive American policy in order to account for what was going on. The Americans aren't out to kind of eject the Soviets from Eastern Europe or cause the Third World War or anything like that. Our goal is to make sure that our part of Europe is secure and doesn't fall into the hands of another major power. But to do that, we adopt policies which the other side is bound to view as threatening. Anything that looks to a buildup of German power, to the underwriting of German national goals as a means of getting the Germans to integrate themselves within the Western Bloc, this is bound to be viewed by the Soviets as threatening. But the more threatening it is, the more likely the Soviets are to take countermeasures. In 1946, for example, there's this bidding war for German favor. This is quite extraordinary, given the Germans don't even have a state of their own. You know, we move ahead. You know, after the reparations stop, we talk in terms of creating some sort of economic entity in Western Germany, leading to the creation of what was called the Buy Zone, the Anglo-American Buy Zone, the merger of the British and the American zones, and agreed on in July 1946 and put into effect on January 1st, 1947. You know, we're moving in a certain direction. And the Soviets react to that by launching an appeal to the Germans, playing the card of German national unity, suggesting that the Germans might find it to their interest to work with the Soviets. We get concerned by the fact that the Germans might be tempted to move in that direction, and we outbid them. Secretary Burns goes over to Germany, gives a famous speech at Stuttgart in September of 1946, you know, appealing to, German nationalist feeling, you know. It's clear that things are moving in a certain direction which the Soviets would find threatening. But the more threatening it is, the more important it is for us to kind of move ahead with a Western strategy, and so on and so on, a spiral dynamic. A very nice example of the security dilemma dynamic in an important international conflict. right? You don't need, you know, pure aggression to have a war. You don't need a Hitler to have a war. A very, very important conclusion. And goes a long way toward explaining why the Cold War came into being and ran its course the way it did. Okay, so let me end there, and next time I'll talk about 48, 49, and see how all this stuff kind of comes to a head.